Welcome to the Criminal Justice Conversations Podcast, a co-production of Berkeley Law School and the Berkeley School of Journalism. I'm your host, David Onick. Criminal Justice Conversations, recorded in the Berkeley School of Journalism studios, features in-depth interviews with a wide range of criminal justice leaders, law enforcement officials, policymakers, advocates, service providers, academics, and others. The program gets behind the soundbites that far too often dominate the public dialogue about criminal justice to have detailed, nuanced conversations about criminal justice policy. Today's guest is actress Sonia Sohn. Sohn starred as police detective Kima Griggs on HBO's The Wire, the series chronicling life on Baltimore's streets. After The Wire ended, she co-founded Rewired for Change, a nonprofit supporting at-risk youth in Baltimore from the same streets portrayed in The Wire. In 2011, Sohn testified before the U.S. Justice Department's National Task Force on Children Exposed to Violence, also known as the Defending Childhood Task Force, about her own exposure to violence as a child. She is a two-time NAACP Image Award nominee and recipient of the Harvard Black Men's Forum 2011 Woman of the Year Award. These days, Sohn can be seen playing homicide detective Samantha Baker on ABC's Body of Proof, and she joins us from a Baltimore studio this morning. Sonia Sohn, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Sonia, as you know, I'm a huge fan of The Wire, and we will talk about the show in a little bit, but I want to start by asking about Rewired for Change. There are a lot of actors and actresses who become involved in social justice issues. They usually lend their names, contribute money, attend events. With Rewired for Change, you've gone far beyond that. You're the founder and CEO and have devoted enormous time and effort into getting the organization off the ground. What motivated you to start your own nonprofit?
Wow. Well, it actually was a string of events. Back in during the 2008 election cycle, some of the actors from The Wire were invited by the National Urban League president Marc Morial to accompany him on a voter empowerment tour of Virginia, educating voters on their rights and voting protocol and whatnot, because they knew there were going to be a lot of first-time voters and such. During that tour, we engaged in some very thought-provoking conversations with Mark and his colleagues on the bus around how celebrity can be used to support grassroots change, and how important entertainers were in the civil rights movement. And he had just observed how that seemed to not be occurring as much now, and what a shame it was. And that seed was planted certainly in me and the fellows who were on that bus at that time. And then just after we completed that tour, we were invited to campaign for now President Obama in North Carolina. And while we were doing that, we got an opportunity to go into a lot of low-income communities and see sort of what our impact was on our fans there. That you know, they had a connection to us that was that we thought was very real and a little different than fans of our. Than other fans who had related to us through other projects. And while we were there, we saw how our interaction with them could inspire folks who may not have ordinarily run down to the polls or volunteered for campaigns. While we were in Carolina campaigning in a lot of underserved, low-income areas, we got an opportunity to see the kind of influence that we had with our fans down there. And, you know, we had various experiences from, you know, guys walking off basketball courts to go vote because, you know, the Wire fellows were there and inviting people to jump in a van and vote, to our you know, kicking it on porches with, you know, guys who were just hanging out. Some of them were drinking and, you know, clearly inebriated. And, you know, we have a conversation with them. And that it, one that started out with, we voted. One guy in particular I remember says, I voted already. And once we got past this wire talk, we started talking about Obama's platform at the time and, you know, asked the guy, you know, gave him some literature and said, listen, you might want to, since you've already voted, you know, you might want to, you know, just share this information with the folks in the neighborhood. He's like, yeah. And, you know, after about 10 minutes, he said, you know what? I lied. I ain't vote. He said, but I'm going to vote now. Watch. I'm going to vote. And we were like, oh, well, you know, we all had a chuckle about that. And we moved on. And the next day, the regional campaign director called us and said, you know, there's a guy down here who's voting and said that he's voting because, you know, the big dude from The Wire told him to vote. And not only is he voting, but he's volunteering for the campaign. And we noticed that that was really important down there. You know, initially we were being taken to historically black colleges and universities. And, you know, we spoke to the driver that was driving us around and said, listen, this is like preaching to the choir. You know, these kids are going to vote or these young people are going to vote. You really should take us to the hood. And then when we went to the hood, you know, we saw that, you know, that's, you know, where we were having the greatest impact. But we also saw that, you know, folks were hanging things on doorknobs and whatnot, but people weren't really paying attention. But when we brought the material in, you know, we could start out with a conversation about The Wire and, you know, our connection to our fans and then move on to something else. And then, you know, we saw that having someone from that community do the same thing would have even more impact because now the community is actually talking about the election, talking about the issues. I ended up staying a little longer than the rest of the fellas. I stayed an extra day and I went back to that neighborhood and ran into another woman just, you know, as I was walking around. And she was like, I heard y'all were here. I missed you. You know, I want to help out. You know, I started talking to her about it and she said, well, you know, they love my cooking. You know, she evidently was, a cook at a local hotel. She said, you know, I'm gonna cook and anybody who brings me their ticket, the ticket that says that they've voted, she said, anybody who brings me their ticket, they'll get a plate. And so we high-fived it. I was like, all right, girl, mama's cooking for Obama. And she said, yeah, and give me some of those, you know, I can put some of those in Miss So-and-so's place. She's got a little candy store she's running out of her house. And, you know, we just had a number of experiences like that, you know, that really struck us. And then right on the heels of that conversation that we were having with, you know, Marc Morial, it just all started to bubble up. You know, there was something bubbling that just wouldn't subside. And when I got back home, at the time I was living in L.A., I just had to get these thoughts out because I was just waking up with them and they were just there and I just started to write them out. And out popped the idea for this nonprofit, which was kind of shocking to me because that's not my background. And I thought, oh my gosh, can I do this? Can we do this? Anyway, there's a longer story there, which I won't go into.
Well, when you came up with the idea, did you have any idea how much work it would take to actually get this thing off the ground?
No, of course not. I was really naive. 3 years down the road and, you know, a number of triumphs, but a boatload of mistakes later. And, excuse me, hard lessons later. You know, I can tell you right now, no, I did not realize that, it was going to be as challenging as it has been. I certainly knew it wasn't going to be easy. But I felt that there was so much support, you know, there was so much support being offered to us. You know, the boys were behind it 100% from the beginning. If they had not been behind it, I certainly wouldn't have done it.
And by the boys, you mean the boys on The Wire?
The fellas from The Wire, yeah. And I say that affectionately. They're like my brothers. And so because they were really supportive and they had been affected similarly to me, I knew I could trust their word when they said, listen, if you can spearhead it, then we'll always be there. I knew I had their support and their love. I mean, we have a deep connection that extends beyond the work on the show. We have a personal affinity and a deep love for each other. And so I knew that I had my family behind me, so to speak. So knowing that, you know, I was able to just, you know, persevere. And then just so many influential people liked the idea and were willing and supported the idea and convinced me that, you know, we could do it. And so we took the dive.
What are some of the moments working with youth at Rewired for Change that stand out to you so far?
Whew. Wow. Oh, my gosh. There's a lot of moments. You know, I would say my first experiences with working with young people through the organization was when we brought a pilot program called Rewired for Life to town. And that program was designed for young people who had been arrested, particularly multiple times, who were in their later teens, who people had whose family members and teachers and, you know, other folks had sort of given up on helping because they seemed to be too far gone. They were the sort of the young people in the too hard basket, you know, difficult to kind of bring into the fold of some other nonprofit programs because they don't really make your numbers look good enough to seek out funding. And I don't. You know, that's not a blanket comment. There are some people doing some amazing work, and there are some of our partners in town who are actually doing some amazing work with that population too. But that was our intent, to bring this program to them, and we used the Wire as a teaching tool. The young people would view episodes of The Wire, and we would engage in themed discussions with goals and objectives, you know, set. And their goal was to really awaken these young people to the idea that personal transformation was A, necessary, and B, attainable. And so through a process of discussion and developing critical thinking skills and having them look at their lives critically, you know, their interactions with their peers, their family members, and through the lens of The Wire, I saw, I along with our first facilitator, Shamsuddin Carpenter, you know, saw a great deal of shifting. And to see a young person's outlook and perception shift over a short period of time is quite amazing. And especially ones who were so, you know, ingrained in a particular lifestyle. But we definitely had a few success stories that really kept us going. And there was a young woman who very early on in the program, like this first week of the program, you know, revealed, you know, to us that, you know, we had a strong sense that she was still out on the streets committing some serious offenses. And, you know, immediately, you know, we saw that there were a number of young people, you know, in that position. But this young woman, you know, we saw her go from that, you know, being in that position to realizing, like, this was really dangerous for this is really dangerous behavior. And then we saw her sort of make the connection between that and needing to get out of that lifestyle if she wanted to have something different. And she played basketball, and basketball was something she loved to do, and she dreamed of playing it in college, but she didn't even have a GED at the time. She was in a very good GED program, Youth Opportunity Baltimore, in here in Baltimore, and they were doing a good job with her. But it was as though, you know, I think their work coupled with, you know, the program that we brought, you know, to their young people kind of pushed her to this next place. Mm-hmm. Where she eventually became she eventually started practicing with a local community college women's basketball team, and the coach told her if she got a GED that she would get her into college and she'd be on the team. And sure enough, it's 2 years later, she got on the team, she got a GED, she got on the team, and she just completed her first year of college.
Now, you've talked about one of the reasons you relate so well to these young folks is because you grew up in very similar circumstances. And last November, you testified before the U.S. Justice Department's Task Force on Children Exposed to Violence, also known as the Defending Childhood Task Force. You talked in a very personal way about your own exposure to violence as a child. What moved you to testify, and what was the experience like for you?
Well, I was asked to testify after participating in a press conference with two other Wire actors, Jim True Frost and Wendell Pierce. We participated in this press conference announcing, you know, the development of this task force with the Attorney General, Eric Holder. And it was, you know, during that time that, you know, part of my – in my remarks, I revealed a little bit about my history, and then I was approached, I guess, several months later to participate in this hearing. And at the time, once I, you know, revealed those details at the press conference and I heard – and I learned about the task force, I let them know that I would be happy to represent this initiative in any way that I could, because I thought it was very important. And there are times when I don't necessarily agree with what the Justice Department is always doing. But that doesn't mean that I can't participate in some of the good work that I think they are doing. That's a whole other conversation, of course.
Yeah. What are some of the experiences that you had that you think you share with some of the young people you're helping today?
Just growing up in, in a neighborhood where every day, going out, going to school, going out going out to the playground can be, a bit of a challenge, to say the least. I mean, I just oftentimes remember, and not that we didn't have great time. I had had great friends. We had fun times, but there were just far, far, far too many days when going outside to play was also fraught with tension and anxiety around, is there going to be a beef today? Am I going to have to defend myself against something today? What kind of fights are going to go on? Or, there was just a lot of – and a lot of us were growing up in, I think – and, we had some healthy families in our neighborhoods, but we also had some families who had challenges like mine. There was domestic violence in my house. And so, being in the house felt being in the house was fraught with tension and anxiety, and sometimes felt unsafe. And going out in the community, with my friends were, there was that same feeling. And so there was always just – it just felt – there always seemed to be some sort of threat. And there was always ways that we would – have to negotiate that threat and somehow, understanding that, I really understood that, I grew up in a neighborhood where there were drugs and there was violence, not to the degree that, violence back in the day when I grew up, it was a lot of hand-to-hand combat, sticks, mm-hmm. Bricks and that kind of thing. The older guys carried, knives and guns and that kind of thing, but they weren't. You had to look to find them. They weren't just, there. People weren't just walking down the street packing as commonly as they are now. But, but all of that was in my neighborhood. And I just know what it's like to feel hopeless, to feel like, gosh, I'm trapped here. Like, I can't – I mean, I grew up in Newport News, Virginia, which was so far from any city. There was no computer. I had the library and the Dewey Decimal – was at the file, I mean, it was like, that was kind of my haven. I would like kind of escape through books a little bit when I go to the library. But, I just felt like, gosh, I've got to suffer through, like really 18 years of this before I can get out and like see the world and see something different. I knew that there was something different for me. And, and there were opportunities for me, but for so many of my friends and for a period of my life, you know, I felt trapped. You know, being home wasn't happy. There was no happiness in my home, and you know, being out in the community sometimes was not an enjoyable place either. And so I found various means of escape, whether it's through risky behavior or through drug use or, you know, yeah, any of those things. So I just kind of know, I knew what the obstacles were, and I knew what these young people were dealing with, and I wanted to. And I saw a particular kind of hopelessness in Baltimore that I had never seen. I hadn't even seen it in New York, to be quite honest with you, because I think New York's a really, even though there's some hardcore hoods in New York, there's a kind of hustle in the hood mentality in New York, and an awareness that there's a level of legitimacy or success that one can attain. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that New York is a really cosmopolitan city and very sophisticated, and everybody gets on the subway train, and, you know, you're exposed to, you know, seeing, you know, people of color in suits and, you know, going into Manhattan and, you know, seeing that other world. It's, you know it's there. And I think in Baltimore, you know, people, especially these young people, you know, don't get an opportunity to see success in the many colors that it comes in and the many ways that it comes in. And it seems so unattainable. And so that really struck me when I came to town, and so it was a different, you know, it was a deeper brand of kind of hopelessness that I really had hoped to try to affect in some way.
Mm-hmm. And given the challenges you faced growing up and that hopelessness, how did you break out and get into acting and eventually get cast on The Wire?
That's a long story, but let me see if I can tell you a really short one. You know, I getting into acting wasn't something that, you know, I aspired to at all. And I fought against it pretty seriously. But I would say I got into it through after I turned my life around a bit when I was in my late 20s. I had become a part of the, you know, being of the spoken word scene in New York. You know, it was the early years of the spoken word scene, and the work that I was that was coming out of me at the time was pretty cathartic. It was, you know, a time when I was engaging in a lot of healing through my through various means, but through my through creative writing was really you know, where I was able to kind of get sort of gut level honest, you know, with myself about my own history. And it was in the way that I would deliver this, you know, this poetry on the stage seemed to allude to the fact that I might be an actress, which I vehemently denied. And one thing led to another, and I was invited to be in an independent film. And then I got
Slam or?
No. That was actually this film called Work, okay, by a director named Rachel Reichman. Oddly enough, I played a young lesbian in that, too. I guess keeps chasing me. Anyway, she told me at the end of that she thought I might have something. I was like, yeah, that's kind of cute, but I'm going back to college. I'm going to be an English major and write my version of the great American novel and teach urban kids English and sort of help them out through being a teacher in an urban high school. But I'm cool. This was cute, but I'm going to keep it moving. And after about 6 months, it just kept niggling at me, and I decided to take an acting class one summer when I was out of school. And when I was in that class at Lee Strasberg, I had a pretty amazing experience that kind of showed me that there was a whole other place to put all of that stuff, and a bigger where I could really truly sort of embody it, and well, not embody it, but just, you know, I could channel it and work with it and mold it, and that's how I began to pursue acting. And then after studying 5 years with Susan Batson in New York, she sort of sent me back out to the poetry world. Just, you know, she said, you know, I'm convinced that you're ready, and that if you just get on the stage and somebody sees you, that you're, you know, you know, you're going to get a hit, basically a bite. And I was like, oh, no, I don't want to go back to poetry. I had moved through that. And now I'm here. Now it's been like 5 years committing to acting. I quit college. I mean, you know, such a passionate artist I am. I just go all the way when I commit to something. At any rate, that's how I ended up in SLAM. And then, you know, the rest is kind of like history.
And briefly, was it from SLAM that you came to the attention of the Wire producers, or how did that connection get made?
No, absolutely not. You know, I came to the attention of Alexa Fogel, the casting director from SLAM, but David Simon had never seen SLAM, hadn't heard of it. None of them knew of that film. And I thought it was really odd because SLAM actually addressed a lot of these issues 10 years before.
And it's based in D.C., right down the road from Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And Mark had Mark Levin has a similar approach to this, you know, to these issues as David. So I thought it was really interesting that, you know, they didn't even they had never met and David didn't know anything about SLAM. But Alexa Fogel did. She saw me in SLAM at Sundance in 98. And when I got back to New York, she really tried to get me a job. She tried to get me a job on Oz. She tried to get me a job with Tom Fontana. And I completely trashed the audition. And she was like, I just know if he sees you, you know, he'll put you in. I just know he'll like you. And then she says, you know, just can you do a poem? And, you know, I mean, she's a really, really special casting director because I think she has a great instinct. And I think that, you know, not that she just has a great instinct, but I think she really understands the puzzle of casting. And if she believes in an actor, she will continue to, you know, work with that actor to find the right role and the right project for that actor. So she works equally for the – I believe – this is my opinion. I believe she works equally as hard for the production side as she does for the talent side. And I think when, you know, someone has that kind of vision, because to me that indicates that there's a sort of bird's eye vision there, that it's not just – you know, I think you're – you know, a casting director can make a better fit. And she stuck with me for a couple of years and really, really worked with me and you know, found the right vehicle. And the same, and she has a very similar story for other actors in The Wire.
Well, yeah, I heard that a lot of them actually also tried out for multiple parts before settling on the part that they got. Did that happen with you, or did they see you from the beginning as Kima Griggs?
No, I auditioned for one role, and that was for Kima.
But let me ask you, though, because you talked about it being the right fit, but you have talked about the struggle you had, particularly at the beginning, playing a cop on TV, given that your view of law enforcement when you were growing up was not exactly a positive one. Can you tell us what that was like to then portray someone in law enforcement in this major role?
Well, yeah, that's been quite a journey, actually. You know, I'm an actor, so, you know, it's my job to, you know, to play all kinds of roles. And oddly enough, I'm copped out now. I'm like, you know, that seems to be one of my major lanes these days, you know. Not that it's a problem, but yeah, it was challenging, you know, but it was an opportunity. You know, that's what challenges are. And that's, you know, the beauty of life. You know, if you are awake and you face a challenge, you get to grow and learn something about yourself and move forward. And so, you know, I was carrying around this resentment of law enforcement. And, you know, in some ways, some of that is legitimate and something needs to be, you know, people need to, you know, police the police and that institution for sure. But at the same time, you know, it's not a personal thing. It doesn't have to be, you know, a personal thing, and it doesn't have to be connected to, you know, internally to, you know, I think it was hardwired in me to in the wrong place. And I think it was an opportunity for me to sort of, you know, rewire, if I may, you know, that little piece. There were some, you know, insensitive cops when I was growing up that I came in contact with. And I found them not helpful in situations when I needed assistance, and also damaging in terms of their reactions to, you know, what was going on in my home when I would call the cops to, you know, help, you know, tame a situation. But, you know, after having to, you know, do ride-alongs with cops and really understand, you know, that was part of my research, you know, to understand why certain people became cops. And, you know, a lot of them, you know, I got a, you know, an inside look at some of the, some, you know, good quote-unquote police, you know, and there's one in, it's a guy in this town, Major Melvin Russell, who's an Eastern District Commander here, who is just an absolute dream and an angel and a godsend to this city. And his focus, you know, he has to do the job of a cop, but he puts a tremendous amount of effort into developing relationships with the community, caring for the community, you know, community police, and connecting, you know, community police into the faith-based movement, and trying. I mean, he's just, you know, he's a, you know, police activist. Anyway, but you know, that was my journey. It was, you know, it was tough, you know, having to go beat Bodie up you know, I definitely went through my challenges that first year, trying to kind of line all of that up, and like I said, sort of, you know, rewire that thing so I could actually do my job. And also, it was a challenge as an actor, because it was like, come on now, this is your job. So, you know, this is part of what you learn to do when you're studying, and it has to transfer on the job. And if it doesn't, then, you know, I'm also looking at it as an actor going, okay, you need to work this out personally and professionally.
Mm-hmm. Now, Rewired for Change is part of an exciting new project launching shortly called the Baltimore Wake Up. What is the Wake Up?
Well, the Wake Up was, you know, is a vision that's shared by Donnie Andrews, who's known as the Real Omar, and who played some bit parts in The Wire, and myself, as a result of our participating, along with other Wire castmates, in a number of panels and presentations and class visits at Harvard between 2009 and 2011. And then the last thing we did together was an urban cities think tank in the spring of 2011. And one of the things that we noticed was there were all these very influential people in business and in government and in academia who were working very hard for, you know, to support marginalized communities and the people, you know, living in them. And we learned a lot there, engaged in a lot of great discussion with a lot of great people. And it was suggested that there be a that maybe we take this sort of panel kind of presentation on the road. I think Donnie and Professor Charles Oglestreet had that idea to begin with. And then when Donnie came to me with that idea, you know, I talked to him about doing something more substantial, where not where we just sort of come to town as a sort of circus act, where we sort of, here's the Wire, here's what we're doing, and you guys should do something too, and then move on. I said we should, you know, we talked to him about having a deeper impact, and we talked about, you know, what we saw at the think tank and how we felt like the people's voice was missing. And so he and I started talking about, you know, just doing something, something a little bit more in-depth, and that's when we came up with this idea to do this Wake Up, which would be more of a of an action campaign on some level. You know, it started out as that, and for like the last 9 months, almost a year, we've been talking to various consultants and pulling together, you know, a team of people to help us get this off the ground. So essentially, you know, the idea is that you know, we all know that there needs to be an improvement in policies that support disenfranchised and marginalized folks. But how do the people, you know, get their voices heard? And these policies could shift a lot more quickly if the people were, you know, if the people were able to be heard in masses. And so how do we, you know, how do we help folks kind of get to the next level where their environment and their lives are transformed in a substantial way. And we started thinking about, you know, community, and that, you know, it first starts with a firm foundation in community. And if the communities aren't bonded and nurtured, and it's not a warm, healthy place for folks to be, then how can anything or any kind of movement or any kind of anything grow from how can anything, you know, how can anything shift from if that's not, you know, if that's not intact? And, you know, we, you know, began to see like, you know, we both grew up in neighborhoods where there was some functionality and there were families doing supporting each other. And then in our work on the streets here, we've seen that, you know, there are people in these communities who want change, who want to, you know, who have great ideas on how to shift things in their neighborhoods, but really didn't have access to the tools and resources that they would need to create that vehicle. And, you know, Donnie and I also saw that, you know, there's this sort of structure or this, you know, format where a lot of nonprofits come and bring services to the people. But how many of these And not that that's a bad thing, but, you know, we need to move to the next step where, you know, where the community is involved in servicing itself. And so we came up with this idea to then to do this day-long community forum where we spend part of the day talking about community and the positive outcomes that that are seen when communities are bonded, you know, and what happens when our communities are fractured. And then, you know, then later latter part of the day will be focused on having community residents explore various kinds of small community building workshops that they could take back to their or activities that they could take back to their communities and execute over a 3-month period. So if you have four mothers in one neighborhood and they're interested in cooking, they agree every Saturday we're going to bring in, you know, some girls in the neighborhood and we're going to bake. If you got brothers who are, you know, basically hanging out in their porches on the weekends anyway, you know, maybe, you know, a few of them will agree that every Saturday that, you know, they're going to spend 2 hours on that, you know, stoop pulling in 15, you know, young men from the ages of 14 to 20 for, you know, just to talk with them and to, you know, about issues, about what they're going through, about, you know, just bonding with them. You know, there are a number of different, and, you know, right now we're developing the specifics of the program, mm-hmm. but, you know, we also have a partner, Parks and People, willing to, you know, to engage in gardening projects and cleanup projects with folks, and people are going to come with their own ideas. But just giving them, you know, a platform, you know, a place where they can come and discuss, you know, not just discuss, you know, what they want to do to better their communities, but actually sort of build that.
And then the idea, right, is that 3 months later you'd reconvene and people would come back and report on the projects they had done. So it keeps it all very action oriented.
Right, exactly. And then from there going, okay, so what did you find out while you were in the middle of those projects? It's not just doing the project, but you're going to get to learn. You're going to learn about right. your neighbors. You're going to learn about the young people. You're going to learn about the issues that are bothering you as a result of, you know, you all just talking and kicking it. And then saying, okay, so what do we want to do? Let's identify those issues. You know, the things that made you angry, the things that broke your heart while you were getting to know, you know, your neighbors. And now, you know, let's look at those issues and let's see, you know, are there policies connected to those issues? And now, you know, let's see about us, you know, coming together as a group, or, you know, are you guys coming together as a group and influencing, you know, that policy in some way? And then basically, you know, the idea is to hand them off to another group of social advocacy, you know, agencies, nonprofits who then lead people or, you know, educate people on how – on the process of actually, you know, making that – making that next connection, you know, yeah. How to go down to City Hall and, you know, make sure your voices are heard. You know, you need to write a petition, you know, you need to go to Annapolis, you need to go down to the school board, just step by step and just trying to keep that going. So essentially, you know, this is our effort to really, you know, we're all these, you know, we're a group of organizations, we're a coalition now. You know, it's not this just Rewire for Change and Why Murder. There are a number of other organizations in this town that feel the same way, and so, you know, we just want to better serve the people that we already serve.
Well, we're really looking forward to keeping our eye on that as it develops. We've talked about some pretty serious stuff here. Let me end on a lighter note and ask you about the parody, The Wire, the musical that you did on Funny or Die. For those listening, if you haven't seen it, you can check it out on YouTube. And there are lots of Wire stars on it, including Michael K. Williams, who plays Omar, and Andre Royo, who plays Bubs, and others. And they're singing and dancing and everyone. It's obvious you're all having a great time. It's really a hilarious video. How did that come about?
Well, hold on. Can I give another plug for the Baltimore Wake Up?
Oh, please do. Please do.
I know that was
by all means.
That was a rather long-winded answer to your question. I just came back from Carolina. You know, I'm from the South. I grew up in Virginia and I have a house in Carolina where I live, basically. And you know, I was just with somebody who said, "God, you guys like to tell these long stories." but if you want to find out more about the Baltimore Wake Up, in the next two days from now, we're doing a fundraising campaign on a site called GiveCorps, GiveCorps. You know, check out the Baltimore Wake Up on GiveCorps, and you'll there's a video that really describes it, that illustrates what we're talking about, and there's language there that will that's concise, and you'll see what we're talking about. And now back to Funny or Die. Funny or Die. You know, I think The Wire was such a serious show. People might not realize that we had a ball working with each other. Those guys are hilarious anyway. Andre's an absolute clown and really has not even begun to do the kind of work that he should be doing. He should be in comedy. And nobody, you know, knew that Michael really was such a ham. And, you know, we always had a lot of fun on set. We had a lot of fun off the set. And so it was great to, you know, to do a Funny or Die skit with those amazing writers, because the writers really, really killed it. You know, that the material was great, and they were fun to work with. And they shot that whole thing in, I think, 12 hours. You know, it was quite a lot of fun.
All right. Well, Sonia Sohn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Please tune in next time when we'll be joined by Laura Fair, the Education Rights Director at Public Counsel Law Center, to discuss reforming the school discipline process. Thank you for listening to the Criminal Justice Conversations podcast. You can find this episode of the program and all prior episodes on our website at www.law.berkeley.edu/CJConversations, on NPR affiliate KLW's website, and on iTunes. You can also become a fan of Criminal Justice Conversations on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at CJ Conversations. Our production assistant is Nicole Jones. Our intern is Lauren Benishu. I'm David Onick. Thanks for listening.